My name is Becky Ward. I work at the Aspen Institute. And I welcome you to this presentation, which is being sponsored by Boeing, on a journey with an Afghan school, educating and empowering the developing world. Our speaker today is Julie Boltz, co-founder of the Journey with an Afghan School program, a project in partnership with the American Friendship Foundation. Since 2002, she has focused on building schools and educating girls in Afghanistan. Please welcome Julie Boltz.
Well, as we would say in Afghanistan, Salaam Alaikum, blessings and may peace be with you. And I am just delighted to be here today. I'm going to take off my chadar so you can hear me more clearly. My family has been coming to the Aspen area since about the 1940s. And earlier this year, I had a chance to come in and talk with kids at Aspen Elementary, Middle, and High School. I also spoke with a couple of book groups. And I subsequently received an invitation to come and speak at the Ideas Festival. And I was just thrilled to be back again. But I have to tell you, it's a little bit intimidating for me. You've seen some of the names that are here. I haven't written a book. I'm not an elected official. I'm not the president or CEO of a major corporation. In fact, those of you who know me know that I spend most of my time in the developing world, where I live in a mud house where there's no electricity or running water. But I'm here today because I have become a voice of about 90 million children today who are in the developing world who are not in school. They are mostly girls, vulnerable orphans. They tend to come from families that make less than $2 a day. And although they don't vote here in America, they certainly are affected by our foreign policy and our corporations. I also represent about 50,000 citizen diplomats who have been journeying with me in this program called Journey with an Afghan School. We are made up of public and private students, family foundations, various religious institutions, nonprofits like National Geographic and Rotary, and even a Fortune 500 company. We have developed a unique model for fighting terrorism. It doesn't require the military. It doesn't require the CIA or Homeland Security. We build schools for kids. And we promote friendships and we develop cross-cultural relationships. And we also share our ideas with other people around the country. And speaking of sharing, just in the past number of years, I've probably spoken about 300 times around the country, all the way from school kids to corporations. I was just in Washington, D.C., meeting with members of Congress, the World Bank, IMF, State Department, U.S. Afghan Women's Council. And by now you might be asking, why are you doing this? Especially because I serve as a volunteer. Because I have a story to tell, a success story that you don't hear very often in the news, in the boardroom, in the halls of Congress. We have taken one of the most poor and oppressed parts of the entire world and are transforming it socially, politically, economically. Education has changed these communities. And right now when you go in, you could see virtually every social indicator has dramatically changed, all the way from birth rates to mortality rates. And in those communities where people used to fight against each other, they've now laid down their weapons and they've come together and working with each other. It's not because of the presence of the military. It's because they're learning to respect each other. The other thing that we have done is to put a face on America that is different than what the terrorists see in the news. We've tried to show that we have the same interests, the same hopes, the same dreams that they have. And likewise in the United States, the people who are participating now see the Muslim community and they don't automatically stereotype them all as terrorists. Finally, what we've done is we've developed a unique, cost-effective model that doesn't require the U.S. government's involvement, but has, by building schools, working in communities, it has been effective in being a change agent, in empowering the poor, and in building dignity. If we can do this in Afghanistan, we can certainly do this in other parts of the world. Finally, the other reason that I'm here is because I believe very strongly in empowering people, not simply there, but here as well. Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has," unquote. So my hope is today is that you all leave today with an understanding that each one of us has the power within us to make a difference in the world, albeit in Afghanistan or in our backyard. All it really requires is for us to step out of our comfort zone and apply that power. So with no further ado, what I'd like to do is to tell you a little bit about myself, how I got involved with this project, my team that's working over in Afghanistan. I'd like to pretend then I was taking you to Afghanistan and introduce you to the history and culture there. And at the end, I would like to show you the school project that we started, Journey with an Afghan School. I also recognize that there are a number of folks here in the audience who are very well-traveled, well-read, who work in Afghanistan, who have lived there for a number of years. So this is a show and tell. And if you have any comments, thoughts, you'll feel free to chime in, okay? Okay, so, I am a lawyer by profession. I actually started out my legal career in Washington, D.C. in one of those big international law firms. I subsequently moved to the other Washington, to Seattle, where I was a partner in a downtown Seattle law firm. I practiced immigration law and international trade law. And if you had met me 9 years ago, I was a partner at that firm. I had a large, successful international practice. And I was also the president of the Washington chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And I guess what you would say is my life was full, secure, comfortable, and predictable. I don't know if there are any other lawyers here in the crowd, but I spent most of my years billing in 6-minute increments. And I did this for a dozen plus years for 3,000 hours a year. And maybe it was those 6-minute increments that finally got to me, but I reached a point in my life where I no longer found a great deal of satisfaction from the hours that I billed, the clients that I represented, the titles that I earned, or the salary that I received. And just about that same time, I was beginning to realize the importance of serving other people and of building relationships. One of my sisters got ovarian cancer. In fact, the sister lives right here in Aspen. And I don't know if this has happened to any of you before, but I found that her touch with death affected me. And I found myself asking, if I only had a month to live, do I like who I am? Do I like what I'm doing? Do I like the legacy that I've left behind? And I looked back at all those years that I was creating Julie the Lawyer, and I didn't like the person I had become. I ended up by taking what was then a 2-year sabbatical. I moved to Africa, to Zimbabwe. And since that time, I have done just about everything you can imagine. I have now worked in about 70 countries across 6 continents, and I have lived in townships where people live in tin sheds and cardboard boxes. I live in mud huts where there's no electricity or running water. I live in war zones where I hear Black Hawk helicopters, gunshots, mortar shells. I see child brides, child soldiers, child prostitutes, children dying of curable diseases, children raising other children with no parents. I could never go back to that beautiful office overlooking Puget Sound. And during the past 8 years, I've been mostly like a general legal counsel to NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the developing world. I've come alongside of them to help them with water projects, microcredit, land reform, things to support them. But I found that my journey changed a couple of years ago. And whereas my colleagues in Afghanistan still live there full time, I found that it was more effective for me to become their storyteller, a voice of the voiceless, in essence, in the developing world. You know, frankly, there aren't that many people who feel comfortable both in a mud hut and in the halls of Congress, and I felt that their story needed to be told. So now I go back and forth. I still spend maybe half the year over in the developing world, but I come back and forth. So with that in mind, I'm actually a part of a team in Afghanistan. That team has been working there since 2001, and the group is called American Friendship Foundation. They live there full time. I mentioned I go back and forth, and I'd like to share just a little bit about who they are and what brings them there. So my team leader is a gentleman named Van. Van is 72 years old. His wife, Janice, is 65. After they retired from their own business, he's a water engineer by profession and she's an RN, they decided to move to Central Asia. They've been over there 15 years and they speak multiple languages. One of the things that's interesting about Central Asia is that age is respect. And in this part of the world, he has been able to accomplish things that I could never be able to do. For instance, a couple years ago, they actually put a ban on foreign NGOs building schools, and Van was one of those who was able to get an exception. Van also received an award last year from the governor of our province for his work and dedication to the people of Afghanistan. This is his wife, Janice. I mentioned she's an RN, and she's out there training trainers about midwifery. This woman is about 29. Here, we lovingly call her Katie the toilet lady, because Katie is a sanitation engineer. And she has been out there and also speaks multiple languages. And this other gal is Anna, and Anna is a photographer. But it just gives you a brief insight into this world. We're actually all American expats, although we've had other foreigners on the team. But I wanted to share a little bit about them with you, because you don't hear about us in the news very often. You don't read about us. In fact, I don't want to be on Oprah. I don't want to be on Time Magazine. For those of you who have lived over in Afghanistan, you know that there has been a $200,000 bounty on our heads for US aid workers, journalists, and military. My friends have been shot, kidnapped. You have heard about schools that have been burned down to the ground, about teachers that have been shot and principals beheaded. So our story is below the radar screen. And one of the reasons I've been out speaking is because I think it's important that you all know that there are actually really good things happening in Afghanistan and you don't hear about it too often. One of the things that has, when I talk to communities, we hear a lot in the news about the military. And you know quite a lot about the lifestyle that they lead. Well, I don't want to do them any injustice today because I have a number of colleagues in the military and I wouldn't want to exchange places with them in a heartbeat. But I do want to give you a little bit of an idea of the differences, especially with some of the military that I know. So if you were in Mazar, where I happen to live in Afghanistan, the north, there is a military base about 15 miles out of town. They focus on logistics. The people who come in go for tours of duty 6 months to a year. They speak English. They rarely leave their compound. The compound is surrounded by sandbags, barbed wire, tanks. In fact, I ran into a woman not too long ago on the plane who had been over in Afghanistan for about 4 years. She had left the compound once during that time. They don't tend to speak foreign languages. They all speak English. They walk down the street wearing camouflage like this, also carrying full weapons. You don't see any women and children or with them, because one of the rules of the military, of USAID, of our US embassy, no spouses, no children for kidnapping purposes. The last thing I'll say about them is that they tend to have their food flown in because they don't want to be poisoned. So it just gives you a quick idea of what they look like. Let me show you the other side. You might not actually know which one is me. My life is I live in the open community. I mentioned, in a house that's made out of mud. We do have electricity, but it's only a couple hours a day. In fact, it's 120 degrees there right now, and we sleep up on the roof to keep cool. We do have running water, but most of my colleagues do not. When I walk down the street, you see this, and I wear a chador over my head. I carry a pencil, I carry a book. Most of my colleagues also have family members out there, So you see a lot of children and spouses. Another thing that's unique about us is that we choose to be there. Many of our colleagues have been there 15 years. They speak multiple languages, and they are volunteers. And lastly, we don't have our food flown in. I get my food from the local market, and most of us have parasites. And as my hosts know, I'm actually taking deworming medicine as I speak. So my life is very different. Well, one of the things when I talk with the school kids in particular, they say, why do you need these NGOs when we spend so much money on the military? So one of the things I just want to briefly talk about is an example. When the war in Afghanistan was just ending, these humanitarian ration packs were dropped all over the country. Do you remember seeing one of these? And so what was interesting about this is we were dropping them at great risk to the pilots who swooped in late at night, dropped these big pallets. It caused a snafu. And instead of helping the people, it caused multiple problems. So, okay, show and tell. Why did this cause a problem? It's in English. Okay, we don't speak English. Ms. Dari. It's a different alphabet. In fact, if you look closely, do you know what language that is? Spanish. Okay, so Spanish and English. All right, keep going. Why else would this cause a snafu? American flag. Is that good or bad? Well, don't know, right? We're at war. Okay, keep going. What else? Falling out of the sky. Okay, well, so we don't know too much about that. Dangerous. Ah, is it food that they're familiar with? I'll talk about that in a second. Well, just look at the outside. Color. Why the color? True story. The same time we drop a million of these around the country, we drop millions of the same color yellow cluster bombs. Kids go to reach up this, and their hands are blown off. True story. And then, if you actually happen to be one of these who get one, I found this in the bazaar for 25 cents. They're starving. No vitamin C, no proteins. What do we give them? Pop-Tarts.
What?
Pop-Tarts. And then they're also, you've heard some of these stories, the peanut butter and jelly, and they had not used peanut butter before, and we saw them feeding the peanut butter to the camels. So the point of this isn't to say, you know, I think that there's a role for the U.S. military, but there's a role for another strategy. And where I come from out of all of this is having now worked in Afghanistan for over 5 years, I believe strongly that it's not the U.S. military that is going to change hearts and minds. It's not the military or these kind of superficial yellow humanitarian ration packs. And I believe that if you want to change the people who are coming, being these terrorists, who are funneling into the system, who are hateful of the Americans, we need to go deeper. We need to get to the roots of terrorism. We need to change their hearts and minds. So some of you at this point might be going, oh, that's really radical. Well, I want to tell you that our 4-star general, who is the Middle East Command, said this back in the fall. The military can do only one thing, buy us time. So one of the things that I have been doing is, you know, how then do we change people's hearts and minds? How do we get to the roots of terrorism? Well, I have been following the philosophy of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He believed that we should do 3 things: engage, educate, and empower. So I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that, because that's the philosophy that I have now taken on. The first one, engage. We need to engage those individuals in the developing world. We need them to get to know who we are. And one of the things that I was very much affected by after 9/11 were protests all over the world. And this is a typical one. It says, Americans think, why are you hated all over the world? This was in Pakistan. Well, having been to many countries all over the world, I have seen that this hatred, this mistrust against Americans, and many of them call us the evil empire. They see us using our military and our economic clout to go into countries to change the politics. They see us using our corporations to disenfranchise the poor or to change or hurt the environment. And one of the things that I have found, and it's much more complicated than what I'm going to present, but many of the images of the United States are formed by the radio, the TV, the movies, the music that we export. Do any of you happen to know what the most watched program is in the developing world? Baywatch. Okay, ladies, so what's our image overseas? Decadent. Kind of sexy. Yeah. Okay, so men, just when you think, oh, this is our image, the second most watched television program in the developing world is World Wrestling. This distrust is not merely in the developing world. It's on this side of the world as well. In fact, when you walk down the street oftentimes and you see a man with a turban, someone will say, oh, he must be a terrorist, one of those. And you hear stories about how people sleep with guns underneath their pillow here in America. One of the things, though, that I have found in my work, and I know that you're a very well-traveled group, and you have probably found this as well in your travels, if you ever have a chance simply to sit down with someone and have a cup of tea, it affords you an opportunity to build bridges and to break down those barriers that have formed between people. And I remember when I was practicing in the former Soviet Union, and there was a woman from Russia who said to me, maybe if we only had more opportunities like this, we wouldn't have had the Cold War. I can't say whether we've had the Cold War or not, but my philosophy has been, just purely out of common sense, that there is a different way to look at terrorism and to counter what we're doing on the national basis right now. We must go beyond asking how safe are our airports, how vigilant is our law enforcement, how accurate is our intelligence. We must be willing to ask the question, how do we make more friends than enemies? And the reality is that our national security really depends on as much on being respected as it does on our ability to keep our enemies obey. The 9/11 Commission report, which has gone mostly unheeded, made a very practical recommendation. It says, quote, we should offer an example of moral leadership in the world, committed to treat people humanely, abide by the rule of law, and be generous and caring to our neighbors. We can offer parents a vision that might give their children a better future, unquote. Well, this recommendation was really focused on government to government. But what we have been doing in Journey with an Afghan School and with other networks around the country, like Our Voices Together, is to come together as a coalition, as networks, to say, let's get people to people involved. There are many things that we all should be doing, can be doing. Meeting our neighbors, reaching out and doing exchanges, reading books that introduce us to the greater world. And I could go on and on about this, but the idea is we have a role to play. And through building this tolerance and learning about different languages, cultures, religious beliefs, that's what also helps build respect and peace. So going back to Martin Luther King, engage, educate, empower, educate. There are about 90 million kids in the world who are not in primary school. Despite most of the reason for that is because of school fees. It might be as little as $50 a year, but it's enough to kind of cancel out most kids, especially girls. But education, statistically, is a building block to eliminating poverty and oppression. If you don't have education, you end up with countries like Afghanistan. So one of the things that's important, education, it opens our minds, it broadens the horizons, it starts to make the extreme less extreme. So one of our work has been engaging in educating kids, especially in Afghanistan. The last one, empowering, especially empowering the poor. If I took a globe and I divided it in half, half of the world is about 3 billion people. 3 billion people today make less than $2 a day. When I talk with the school kids, you know, I ask, what do you do with $2 a day? What can you buy with that? Does it buy a new winter coat? Can you buy a new pair of shoes? Can you buy a healthy meal? Of course not. You buy frustration, resentment, and anger. And if we don't start helping and empowering the poor, other people will, and we've already seen that in the Middle East. So with that in mind, Afghanistan, people don't even make $2 a day, it's $1. And when I first went into Afghanistan, it was the poorest in the world. And the United Nations has a list. Who's the poorest of the poor? Afghanistan was at top. And it led the world in child mortality, maternal mortality, landmine victims, homelessness. 1 out of 4 were homeless. Literacy, 6%. Life expectancy, 43. Life in Afghanistan was very difficult. Well, it wasn't just the poverty, it was the oppression. And we all heard stories about the Taliban, and especially for girls and women, it was very difficult. They were not allowed to leave the house without a male relative. Windows were blackened, so women couldn't look out, men couldn't look in, could not go to school, could not work, could not wear heels that clacked. Life was difficult. Well, life for men was also hard. We heard stories about how men had to have their beard to a certain length, and if they didn't, they were persecuted. There was no music, soccer, kite flying, chess playing, so life for men was difficult as well. And we heard stories about how they had taken soccer stadiums and turned them into places where kids no longer played soccer, but men and women were persecuted. So, with that background information, what I'd like to do is now take you to Afghanistan. Hope those of you who can see, if you took a globe and you literally flipped it over, it's on the opposite side of the world. 10 o'clock in the morning is about 10 o'clock at night there. But what I want to point out to you is that it's in a strategic location. Afghanistan is in an economic transit zone that for centuries people went north and south and east and west. One of the things that happens when you're in an economic transit zone is that you are subject to people wanting to capture you because your strategic location. And that's just what happened to Afghanistan over time. And if you took a timeline and you went down through history, you would see all the way from Alexander the Great to the Arabs, the Mongols, the Chinese, the Turks, the Huns, the Brits, the Soviets, the Americans. We were all in Afghanistan. I want to take you, though, to 1979. 1979 is the year the former Soviet Union invades through the north into Afghanistan. For almost 10 years, the Afghans are fighting back. This is the Cold War era, so you can just imagine going back at that time. Towards the end of this, 1989, the U.S. starts supplying money and weapons to a group in Pakistan called the Mujahideen. With our help, the Mujahideen turns the Soviets back across the border, now almost the end of the Cold War. United States pulls out. We create a power vacuum. And those powerful Mujahideen warriors that we had supplied start fighting each other. They have their own militias, their own tanks, the whole thing. Millions of Afghans are killed. During this time, they also start growing poppies. You all know what poppies are used for? Heroin, opium. It becomes the most, the largest drug poppy producing country in the world. And with poppies and drugs also comes crimes, corruption, bribery. Afghanistan starts going down. Whenever you have a political reaction over here, you tend to get a reaction. Again, I'm simplifying matters here, but what happens at this time is enter a group called the Taliban. A Talib is a religious scholar. He originally comes in because part he wants to clean up what's going on over here. But you all know the end of the story. They start bringing in their very extreme views, and they start exterminating a number of the ethnic groups that they don't support. So just from a timeline perspective, one of the things that the Taliban also did is they allowed a group called Al-Qaeda to set up training camps in Afghanistan. The pilots that flew into the Pentagon as well as the Twin Towers are part of those groups, as you know. September 11th happens. The U.S. military goes in October. The Taliban's removed from power in December. And my team and I go in at the end of December, beginning of January. So when you get to Afghanistan, you say, what are they fighting about? Because it looks like you're going back to Marco Polo. And it's about, for me, is this location, location, location. Right. Here's a blow-up of Afghanistan. The capital is Kabul. Running perpendicularly down the country is the Hindu Kush. It goes all the way up to 21,000 feet. And kind of like Colorado, one side is green and more lush. I live on the eastern Colorado side. Very dry, 120 degrees, looks like a desert. In the winter, it snows and it gets very cold. I am up in the north in a city called Mazar-e Sharif. It is the home of the Silk Road. And so if you look at people in our area, you will find people with red hair and blue eyes, brown hair, dark eyes. It's that melting pot of all those different cultures that have come together. It's a strategic area within a strategic country, because if you can make a difference there, there's going to be a ripple effect that goes into these other countries. There are multiple languages. Shiite, Sunni, Sufi are also up in that area. It was the home of the Northern Alliance. It is probably one of the most progressive and American welcoming parts of Afghanistan. So that was another reason why we chose to work there. When you come into a country like Afghanistan, what hits you the most is that it's an Islamic nation. And 99% of the people in Afghanistan practice Islam. The word Islam itself means submission to God, and a person who submits to God is a Muslim. Well, one of the things I also found about Islam is that it's not simply a religion. It dictates culture. Eating, how you live, everything about you, and your clothes. And if I were to tell you more about Afghan culture, I would need to start with the pecking order, because men are on top, then boys, then women, and then girls. So if you don't mind, I'm going to share with you a little bit about Afghan culture using their hats. Just like the United States, if someone had on a hat that said the Yankees or someone who had the Boston Red Sox, you would know a little bit about where they came from and who they support. Same thing in Afghanistan. Their hat tells a story. The hat tells me if they're rich, if they're poor, if what their ethnic group is. So let me just demonstrate. I'm going to use some of the ladies here town too. If you saw something like this, it means that going to the mosque today. If a person was wearing a hat like this, from Tajikistan. This one, Uzbekistan. Okay? Sorry, Uzbek? Turkmen. This Turkmen hat has a little thing on it, means that you're getting married today. This one, going to school, a celebration. And anyone recognize this hat? Who said that? Karzai. Actually, do you want to come up? I need a man. So if you saw a hat like this, it's used Pashtun. And you'll see President Karzai wears this when he's on TV. He also wears his cloak. And it too tells a story. So there's President Karzai.
I look just like him.
President Karzai might also, well, if he were an Afghan man, he would wear something similar to what I'm wearing, same sort of outfit. These are the pants that a man would wear. So I have to tell you, I'm actually wearing the same sort of pants. They have an elastic in them. But the idea is, it's 120 degrees, it's hot, there's no air conditioning, and this is really practical. And so this keeps men cool and women during the summer months. Okay, so Craig, you want to help me a second? Okay, anyone know what this is? Turban material. Same thing. It tells a story. It tells if you're rich, you're poor, what tribe you're from. This is made out of silk. So what would that say?
Rich.
Okay. So don't put this in your mouth, but just hold it up.
Hold it up?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing this quickly, but if a man were to tie the turban, it would be very done in a way that describes his heritage. And some of you who have seen a Hindu man tie a turban is probably twice as long, very elaborate. But the turban tells a story. I mentioned that the color, the type of material, and even the way that he has this hanging down. If it's down, he's Uzbek. If it's up, he's Turkmen. And so it tells me about, in the community, where he is. And oftentimes, it's like the Scottish kilt as well. You can tell the different ethnic groups. Same thing with this. In fact, if you look on TV and you see a man wearing a black and white turban, do you know where he might be from? Palestine. Red and white? That's Saudi, by that area. So the other thing, when I talk to the kids, I describe that sometimes they go like this. And the kids, of course, go, oh, he must be a bandit. Well, he's not a bandit. The sun is blowing. It's hot out there. The sand is blowing. He's practical. He's using this to protect his face. So part of this, the reason I do this is if we want to get to know a culture, we have to understand also why they do what they do. So thank you, gentlemen. And you can just leave that up. It's the designs usually. Well, and the colors that might be in it. And so if you look up on the screen, you'll see some of the people wearing the turbans and the hats.
And why do they wear turbans?
Well, the turban, let me jump back a second. Actually, during the time of the Taliban, men were required to wear a turban. It was part of their religious belief and practice. And one of the first things that happened after the Taliban was removed, you saw people wearing their ethnic hats again. Another thing that you saw is that men shaved, and it was a sign of freedom. So Turkmen community, the flaps up, Uzbek community. Okay, now just turning over to the women's side of the world, you would never see a group like this in Afghanistan. Women are always separated from the men. Women lead a very different life, and they're mostly at home in their compound, and men are much more out in the community. I'm a little bit unique because, frankly, they don't know what to do with folks like me that cross both boundaries. And one of the reasons is, remember, I have the purse strings. So I get invited into the man's world quite a lot. But in a typical situation, you would find the woman like this. And when a woman goes outside, or even when I have guests over at the house, I wear something over my head called a chador. And I look like this. When an Afghan woman goes outside, she wears something over her head called a burqa. Do you want to come demonstrate?
Sure.
Any girl that has gotten her period would need to be covered. Do you want to try it? So as these ladies are putting this on, I'll just describe a little bit, because during the time in the Taliban, burqas were required. Women didn't always wear burqas in Afghanistan, But burqas actually go back several centuries. It's not anything new to that part of the world. And one of the interesting things about burqas is that I mentioned that girls are at the bottom of the pecking order, yet they are the honor of their family. And I'll tell you, heaven forbid she is not a virgin at the time she gets married, because she probably would be killed and her family would be disgraced. So one of the things that they do is they literally kind of close her off from men. And even today, most of the marriages are arranged, and most men and women will not meet each other until their marriage day. Today, most men also, they would not see the faces of any of the women in their community. They would see their daughters, their wives, their sisters, their mother, and maybe a few first cousins. So you can kind of imagine how strange it is now to see the faces of a lot of the development workers who are coming in. So tell us, how does it feel in there?
It feels a little bit secretive, because I feel I can watch everyone who can't see me. And I feel almost invisible in here. It's very cumbersome. The weight in the back pulls it down, so it wants to shift the limited amount of view that I have. So I can see also it can be very awkward if that were to shift. There's no way to, you really can't see it. It's a little bit fuzzy.
So another thing that you would typically see in Afghanistan is, of course, something like this, right? Because she can't use her hands. And you see carrying children in her arms, but water or bags on her head. One of the things that's been interesting about this is a number of years ago when I first came in, I mentioned I'm a human rights lawyer, there was a real movement to help get burqas off of women. But what happened is women went like this, and men threw acid on their faces. So in my community, I'm going to venture to guess that about 95% of the women still wear these burqas. And when I do the show and tells, there's a part of me that really wants to put these on men. Because the bottom line is, see, it's not women necessarily who are going to have the power to take this off. It's the men who are going to have to say it's okay for that to happen. So part of the human rights movement is not simply segregating out women, but it's educating the whole community. So thank you, ladies. Well, underneath it, you'd have something like this.
Wow.
So, of course, it's boiling hot. And you see women fainting in the street all the time. Yeah. Okay, so let me show you a couple pictures of women. Here we are. We're up there by the former Soviet Union. It's the place where the Soviets invaded. It's also the home of the Northern Alliance. This is what it looks like to be in a war zone. This is a war front. If you want to kill people most effectively, what do? You turn off their water. You destroy the irrigation. And that's just what happened. So this area became, within Afghanistan, one of the most poor spots. And it looks, again, like you're going back to Marco Polo. Many of you have traveled to the developing world, so you've probably seen villages like this. It's just very simple, made out of mud. People tend to congregate by families. They speak the same language. In Islam, a man can marry four times. So oftentimes you'll find in a compound a husband, his four wives, and other relatives. Again, you're going into the developing world. They call it developing because there's no infrastructure. There's no running water, no electricity, no highways. It's very simple. And if you're making less than $2 a day, you live in a house that's just made of the earth. And so these are thick adobe-like homes, and they're made out of mud and water and sunlight. One of the things about this area is that we're also in an earthquake zone, and you can imagine that during earthquakes, this is the area that just collapses as well. Inside a home, again, if you're making less than $2 a day, you don't have furniture. You do everything on the floor. So there are no photos, there are no pictures, there's no table, chairs, beds. Many times people, though, have a big, beautiful rug that they would use on the floor. Of course, when there's no electricity, you have to cook differently, and your life is different with no lights and computers and things like that. And, of course, water is the most important thing to a community. This well is 150 feet deep. That's the size of a 15-story building. But if you don't have water, you don't survive. Well, this is really where my story begins. Because one of the things that happens in a war zone, the people who are affected the most aren't the men, aren't the women, it's the children. One out of four kids in Afghanistan dies by the age of five. Many of these kids are being sold off to older men at age 7 to 9 as a child bride. Many of them are also being sold into Pakistan as carpet weavers. The going rate for a child, $14. And when we went into these communities and we said, what can we do? How can we make a difference? Time after time, what the community leaders said is, build us schools. And they were the first to realize that education is the building block to eliminating the poverty, the oppression, and extremism in their community. And for those of you who are educators, you know that there are statistics that link virtually every social illness to education. Now, child mortality, maternal mortality, landmine victims, malnutrition, harmful traditional practices, female genital mutilation, child slavery. You can tie these things into education. So one of the things that happened after the Taliban is now kids can go to school. And there are schools available that are simply not madrasas. But nothing exists. They've all been destroyed. All the teachers have either abandoned the communities or they've been shot. There are no textbooks, there are no school supplies, there's nothing. And oftentimes what we saw are kids sitting out in fields or in tents. So I went back to Seattle, and this was the picture really that was etched on my heart. These kids sitting out there, 120 degrees, dust blowing, and trying to learn. And I went out to my community, and I started raising quarters and dollars. And I challenged kids in my community to raise 50 cents a week for 10 weeks. And what I found is that not only did they raise their $5, then their parents came in, their neighbors came in, and we started enough to raise a school. Our first school cost us about $30,000. So what I'd like to do is just take you on a little journey of that school so you can get an idea of kind of what that looks like. The money is sent to my team in Afghanistan. This man is now gone, but his name is Rob. He's a Texan. He lived over in that part of the world 15 years, speaks 4 different languages, one of the most well-respected development workers in that whole area. And we come together with communities, and we work together to figure out where to go, what to do. I am approached by probably 100 communities a year, and I get to choose one. So we look at who's in the community, what leadership they have, do they want to work with us, what type of teachers do they have, will they sustain the school, do they want to educate girls, bring all those things together. I love the way that Rob has his hands. They have a great saying in that part of the world. It says, it takes two hands to clap. So in essence, if I just supply the schools and the money, I go like this, and I get tired, and I go away. But if they come in and they help supply teachers and guards and property for the school, and we come together, now we're going like this, and we're working together. And in fact, when I first started this program, I called it Adopt an Afghan School. Well, you can see, it's not about adopting, it's journey, right? It's empowering them and supporting them. So once that's all in place, we start a school. And here we are at a groundbreaking ceremony. And let me just flip through so you get an idea of what we do and how we build in Afghanistan. Yes, we hire Afghan workers, we train them, we provide supplies, and we pay them. Yeah.
Do they make their own bricks?
They do make their own bricks.
How long does it take?
A couple of months. So this is the first school that we did. It was a school for 420 girls in this region. It was the first school that had been built up in this part of the country. And every school has a story of why we went in there. And the leading story on this one is a woman who became my hero. And her name is Cobra. She's the principal of this school, and she came to us and she said, Julie, I know you have 100 other folks who come to you. Come to us. I will knock on every single door in my community. I will get those girls to school. I will bring you teachers. Well, during the time of the Taliban, Cobra had an underground school, and she used to put books underneath her burqa, and she would serve these kids. She could have been shot at any time, but education was so important to her that she continued. She's the second wife to a Mujahideen warrior who was killed during the Soviet age, and she supported, with wife number one, 12 other kids. So Cobra, on the day we opened, had 420 girls and 8 teachers. All of the kids were in first grade, whether you were 4 years old or 18 years old. The school is secular, and each grade they learn different things, all the way from math, geography, Dari, Pashtun, English, biology, physics. I did. And one of the things we also did when we first started, I mentioned there were no supplies, no textbooks, nothing. So we brought in containers full to be able to start at the beginning. We don't do that now, but it is something that was important when we first started. But we don't simply want to build schools. And what makes our project a little bit different than some of my colleagues out there is that we want to build relationships. We want them to get to know us. We want to get to know them. So we engage in cross-cultural projects to teach the kids about us and to learn about them. We have learned, we have done things where they tell us about the clothes they wear and the food they eat and their families, and they take their pictures. And we send things back and forth, poems, songs, photos. How do they accept us? Well, we have to have everything cleared with them before we start, and the school actually is turned over to the government after we're completed.
What kind of books would they read?
Well, the books that they would read would be in Dari, and they would mostly be the textbooks that they would get from the government. Yeah. So here you can see just some of the exchanges that we're doing. Yeah. So the question is, how do they get around to doing pictures and photographs and even the dolls? So what my understanding is that just like the burqa, there are different ways to interpret the Quran on this. Do you wear it all the time? What is it for? And part of the belief is from an idolatry standpoint. So the groups that we have been working with, who have been, I would say, more moderate, don't believe that your spirit will be destroyed by doing a photograph or a depiction of a human. I don't know if, James, if you have any thought on the using of people in photographs and things like that in your experience.
No, it's kind of superstition.
Yeah.
It's changed over the years.
Yeah. James and his... Yeah. Right. Right. Correct. 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 But there are different ways of viewing it. Yep. It's a good point you raise. Well, the teachers mostly have a primary school education, and it's one of the biggest issues there because in order to lift these kids up, we need to get the teachers more educated. Correct.
So they only
have the question is, are we bringing in teachers from other places? And part of this is because the villages tend to be small units and having their own languages. And so in this community, most of the folks are actually Uzbek and Turkmen. So in the cities where we're also working, it's a little bit different. But this just gives you an idea. And over at my display table, you'll see a number of the things that the kids have sent back and forth. But One of the schools that I'd love just to tell you about is the sister school to this one in Afghanistan, and it gives you an idea of what we're trying to do. The school in Seattle is a public school, and they actually lost their school in a fire at the time I approached them. So it was kids who lost a school interested in helping kids who never had a school. And they got together, they started raising their dimes and quarters, they gave up birthday presents, they gave up Christmas presents, they went out and they raked leaves and mowed lawns. But it was the kids who had an interest in helping kids. Today we have teachers who are involved in cross-cultural exchanges. The principal of the school just went to Afghanistan with me, and they have really served as a model for what it means to have kids help kids. And they have gotten in national magazines, but it gives you an idea of what empowerment looks like. And in fact, some of the kids just went to Washington, D.C. with me to lobby our representatives and senators about these issues. No, not yet. And so it just gives you an idea. We have hooked up communities here with communities there. We are now starting our 10th brand new school. Most of our schools are big. They serve several thousand kids. We have repaired about 12 other schools. So we have 22 schools. We serve about 20,000 kids, 140,000 family members. And in addition to doing schools, we're digging wells. We've done about 80 of those. We are doing curriculum development, teacher training, textbook distribution, libraries, and all the things that you need in order to almost create a school system. In fact, our next school is kind of an exciting one. It's a school in Mazar-e Sharif. It's a big one for 3,600 kids. And one of our partners on this is National Geographic. Wow. They had that fund that was developed because of the Afghan girl, and so they're a partner in the school. And the thing that's also great about this is the Aspen community is the group that's linked into this school. And when we did the groundbreaking a couple of weeks ago, you can see there's a poster, a gift from the kids in Aspen for that. So, well, one of the things that the former Secretary General of the United Nations has said, Kofi Annan, if you educate a girl, you educate a family. If you educate a family, you educate a community. If you educate a community, you change a country. And so I did a study, and I wanted to find out, are we working? Have the schools actually made a difference? And I interviewed about 200 girls and boys and teachers. And what I found was really phenomenal. Every single indicator that we had heard about with education had changed. Mortality rates had gone down. Birth rates had gone down. In fact, when we asked a woman, a girl, how many children does your mother have? 14. How many would you like? 2. How many wives does your father have? 4. How many would you like? 1. A couple years ago, there was severe depression, especially among girls and women. Remember, they couldn't leave the house, the windows were darkened. There was just a new expression in these communities. And one of the things I personally liked was I asked the same question a couple years ago. What do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody could think beyond tomorrow. They were so focused on survival. They couldn't think, what do I want to be tomorrow? So today I asked 3 girls, what do you want to be? A teacher. Why do you want to be a teacher? Because I want to make sure there's more than the Quran in my community. I want the girls to learn about math and how to write and how to read. What do you want to be when you grow up? A teacher. Why? Because I want my country to have dignity. I want us to be free of foreign intervention. What do you want to be when you grow up? I don't want to be a teacher. I want to be the Minister of Education. Why is that? Because I want to make sure that all girls have a chance to go to school. Another person that I interviewed was the Minister of Education. And I said, in the 5 years that we've been working here, what would you say is the most important thing that we've done? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, you've given us hope. Hope. And I said, can you tell me one story that I can pass on? And he told me the story about this little girl. I don't know her name, but I'm going to call her Parvana. Well, Parvana is about 9 years old, and after the Taliban, she has an opportunity to go to school. But her father won't let her. Day after day, she watches her classmates with great excitement going into school and coming back. One day, Parvana shows up at school. And I remember Cobra approached her, and everyone was very concerned. What are you doing at school? If your father finds out, you might be stoned, you might be killed. Maybe you should go home. This little girl said, no, education is so important to me, I am going to continue going to school. So day after day, Parvana comes to school. One day, you can imagine what happens, she doesn't show up. And we're all sick, you know, wondering what happened to this little girl. Well, the story is this. She comes from a family that had never learned to read. Her father's illiterate. The father had gotten a letter in the mail that week from a relative in Pakistan. He couldn't read it. And this little 9-year-old girl steps up and says, Dad, I can read that letter for you. And instead of stoning her, he embraced her. And he was very proud that this was the first person in his entire family who could read. And I have to tell you, that story reverberated all over our community. We went from 420 girls to 1,000. We went from 8 teachers to over 20. That little school, kind of in the middle of nowhere, was a magnet, and girls' schools started popping up all over the place. And this is why I am utterly, positively convinced that it's not the U.S. military that is going to change Afghanistan. It's the little 9-year-old girls in the world, like Parvana and Cobra, who are willing to risk their lives because education is so important to them. I'm just going to tell one more story, then I'll. When you talk about hope, I just want to give you one other picture. In these communities, there were people who spoke Turkmen, Tajik, Pashtun, Uzbek. They had fought each other during the Mujahideen days, fought each other during the Northern Alliance days. And a community also came to us and they said, if you come in the middle, we will lay down our arms and we will work together. And that's just what we did. We built a school, and today, when you go into the classroom, they're speaking the same language, Dari. And PTAs have been formed within these communities. They're coming together. And if you look closely at the picture, you're going to see that they're wearing all different hats representing those different communities. Same with the adults. And then one other thing that we saw is that if you had come to one of those schools 5 years ago, the kids carried AK-47s with them. Weapons, fighting, arguing, no respect for themselves, for the teachers, or anyone else in their community. They couldn't communicate with each other because they all spoke these different languages. But today, when you go into the schools, this is what you see. The kids have come together. So putting aside the fact of reading, writing, arithmetic, what these schools are doing is nation building. It's nation building. So I just want to end with 4 ideas for you all. The first one is, I strongly believe that Afghanistan is in a strategic place, in a strategic time. And that if you can change Afghanistan, it will stabilize and modernize that whole part of the world. Because if you drop the pebble, just like you've dropped into these communities, it will reverberate. So I believe that we need to continue being engaged within Afghanistan. Idea 2, I believe that it's absolutely positively necessary to get these 90 million kids into school. And I hope to be able to use this project of showing the success of what we've been able to do in this country to leverage it to show you the importance of educating girls all over the world. And so one of the things that I've done is I gave a handout up there. You have the power to make the differences. We have power through our representatives and senators to ask them to make a change within our foreign policy, in our foreign aid budget. Right now, we are at 0.01%. What if we would bring it to 0.02? What a change we might be able to make in this world. So I would ask that you might pick up a letter over here and write or call your senator or representative. And the third is, as much as the U.S. is engaging, it's up to us also to step forward. They're really not the people who are the best at bridge building, engaging, empowering, and educating. It takes folks like us. So I would hope that all of you, through your efforts of whether you're supporting organizations out in the developing world, whether you use your expertise, you don't have to be retired. It might be just a vacation that you decide to do this, but to get out there. And the last idea is, you don't need to go to Afghanistan to make a difference. You can start right here in your backyard. It's about that people to people, getting people together, reading more, going to an interfaith service, inviting people into your home as an exchange student, all the various things that you can do right here and now. And I want to end on this photo. I don't know if you can see it in the back, but it says, Afghans and Americans are brothers. This is taken at the boys' school that is right next to that girls' school. These aren't kids who hate us. These are kids who want to get to know us, who want to work with us, and hopefully would want to come and maybe visit someday. But it gives you an idea of what this transformation looks like. And I'm glad to take questions at the end, but I just want to say thank you the way that we would do this in Afghanistan. People put their hands over their heart. It's almost as if we're saying thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I just want to say thank you for all of you today for being willing to listen to the story of kids on the other side of the world who don't have a voice, who don't really have much to offer you, but play a big part in this world. And I thank you for listening to my ideas today. So, tashakor. So, Becky, I know we're probably way over time at this point, so I know some people might need to run off. Okay. Yes.
Have you met Greg Mortensen?
Question was, have I met Greg Mortensen? I have met him, and he is doing kind of similar things that I'm doing. He's mostly up in northeastern Afghanistan, but his philosophy really has been build schools, and he has built about 200 of them, but he hasn't been focusing as much as building those bridges. And so my hope has really been to focus on that and to have communities join to communities. We're representing probably the same amount of kids, and just in a different way.
Julie is a monogamous society.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you deal with the problem of men not letting their kids go to school? I mean, apparently it's working, but meetings and all those kinds of issues that come up. Can you just let the community deal with that?
So the question is, how do we deal with men who don't want their children to go to school? I think what's been happening is that ripple effect, and it's slow. It's just going to be slow, and it's the same thing with the burqa. It has to start within, and I think them seeing the benefit of having girls educated. One of the biggest problems that we have right now is that girls are the carpet weavers in families, and so they can get a lot more by the girls selling carpets than they can by going to school. So part of the challenge is to be able to show that there's room for maybe both. Yeah. The question is about Quranic schools. And oftentimes they're completely separated. In fact, a Quranic school might be called a madrasa. And so a madrasa is where children are selected, or sometimes they're just open for the general public. But the children study the Quran 24 hours a day. In the secular schools, they also learn the other subjects. Now, in ours, the Quran is also taught, as is Islamic law. In our schools, but it's a small portion, and that is actually required by the government. So, but the conflict is, for those people who are more of the extremists, their belief is that all of the schools should be the madrasa schools.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are the political issues that you see? I mean, you said something about the price on your heads and so on.
Yes.
How do the people react to that? If something like this happens, what is the reaction?
So the question is about the political situation there, and how do people react really to the presence of, I'm going to say Americans in particular, if that's okay. Yes. Well, two things. One is, I am going into communities where I'm invited. So that has been something that's been important to us. So hospitality within this part of the world is key. And I would venture to guess that if anything happened to me, that someone would step forward and actually take the shot. And we have seen stories, I know of them firsthand, where someone has been kidnapped, where the Afghan women step forward and say, take me. So that is a very strong belief. And in fact, my personal belief is that if Osama bin Laden is still out there, that he is the guest of someone. Because if you're the guest, you're not going to turn that person in. So with regard to also the burning of the schools and things like that, we have gone into communities where specifically they have asked for girls' schools and for these schools. And they have come together as a community to do that. So it's not a one lone voice, it's a community. So our strategy has been not to go out to some of these areas in the south, which is a big issue, but to deal with those people starting in the north, hoping that there'll be a ripple effect. And just to give you an idea, like on the ripple effect, during the past election for parliament, we had more women voting and running for parliament than any other part of the country. So again, the hope is that ripple effect starts occurring. Yes? Right. So we actually do have a number of folks in the Afghan American community who are always running through Seattle. In fact, there's a whole group of 20 lawyers right now at the University of Washington. We have had folks from the Afghan and the local Afghan community participating with us as well on those cultural exchange items. And I know that the folks in California are doing sort of the same thing. I'm showing you the pictures of most of the Americans in the group, but we hire over 100 Afghans on our staff and in the communities to help us run these things. So there's we try to do as much as we can, because ultimately it's their project. It's their schools, it's their whole thing. So my hope is not to stay in Afghanistan, and I hope 5 years from now you won't see me doing this project. So I think that those folks though add a really important facet into working in Afghanistan. One of the things that I have seen though with the Afghan community here in the US is that many folks left during the Soviet days. And so when I have had even individuals coming in from the Afghan embassy and I show these pictures, they say, that's not what it looks like in Afghanistan. I've never seen this stuff. And many of those folks have not followed what's been happening in their country. It used to be it was a beautiful country. Kabul was like Tehran, and women wore short skirts. And the influences that we're seeing now from Iran are actually fairly positive. A number of the folks coming in are the educated ones. They have a lot to offer. They're the progressive ones, helping to change even what women are wearing in the textbooks. So there's an influence that goes back and forth. And one of the things that we found that these schools also did is integrate that huge amount of refugees. Remember, a quarter of the population was homeless. So those schools really integrated the country together. Well, I think a couple of things. One is, I want you to leave knowing that your vote as a citizen means a great deal. And right now, the philosophy that the U.S. has been doing to support terrorism is pretty one-sided if you look at the budget. And what I have been trying to, I guess my ideas today is that we need to make room for other strategies. We need to put money into some of these other ways, not simply the military. We need to focus on education in a lot of these countries. You can put money into those. And I also think we need to support the groups that are out there doing these things. So it's writing letters, calling your representatives on the phone, it's volunteering, bringing people into your house. So all the way from up here to down here. And maybe there are some corporate leaders here who are the presidents of CEOs, and you have businesses overseas. What about having your employees learn a foreign language? What about encouraging your employees to live in the local communities? And there are a lot of things that we can all do, whatever layer we're at. So. Yes? How many troops? I actually don't know. Is it, I think, 15,000? How many troops are in the from the U.S. there? I mean, one of the misunderstandings that people had for years is that we had thousands of them over there. Well, for most of the 5 years, we have had 5,000 troops, and they've been based out of Kabul. And it was a big secured zone around there, and nobody else was there. So now the U.S. troops are along that Pakistani-Afghan border, and you see them engaging in a lot more activities. But the rest of the country, it's the United Nations troops that are out there. So. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to ask questions later, but I know that you all move on to the next event. So thank you for coming today.